Hello, everyone. Welcome to this latest episode of the B2B Marketing Podcast. My name is David Rowlands. I'm the head of content at B2B Marketing and Propolis, which is the global community for B2B marketers. And I'm joined today by the chief creative officer at experience innovation company, Valtech. So, David, thank you. How are you doing today?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Great.
No problem. So first things first, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background in B2B?
Sure. Yeah, I've been helping businesses and brands innovate at the intersection of creativity, technology, and culture for over two decades now. So my background is in design and product and service innovation, but I've also spent quite a bit of time in the advertising world too. And I've been lucky enough to work over those years with clients such as Lego, Marvel, Google, ESPN, MailChimp, and Samsung.
Interesting. So Lego and Marvel, two very well-known brands. What led you to the B2B side of things, do you think?
I mean, it's, you know, I think it's interesting. I never sort of being in the agency world for so long, you're doing a lot of work with B2C brands. You don't think of yourself working in a B2B industry, but, you know, that's at the end of the day, that's the industry that I've been in my whole life, is really, you know, doing work for other businesses.
Yeah, fair enough. So can you tell us a bit about Valtech itself then? Because I know, I mean, today we're going to talk about the big rebrand and your role within that, but it'd be good to understand a bit about the company first, just so our listeners kind of know what you had to work with.
Sure, sure. I mean, obviously with the name Valtech, you know, our roots are in, you know, technology, and we've grown over the years to be in a place where we help companies lead and innovate. And what we're seeing is a digitally accelerated world, right? And we do that by bringing teams together at the intersection of strategy, design, data, engineering, and communication. So we're over 6,000 employees now. We're global. We're in over 60 offices around the world. We also have deep vertical expertise in categories such as automotive, luxury, travel and hospitality, and others. And some of the clients that we do work for are Bose, Dolby, Universal Studios, P&G, Audi, and Mars.
Sure thing. So, I mean, 6,000 staff worldwide or thereabouts, some huge clients. I think it's fair to say, you know, a rebrand on that kind of scale is always going to be quite a big operation. So what actually was the impetus behind having that brand refresh in the first place?
Yeah. Great question. There's a couple of factors that led us to this. The first was scale. So we doubled in size over the last 5 years. I've been at Valtech almost 3 years now. A lot of growth, and at the size that we're at now, you know, clients are looking for fewer scaled partners to do more for them. You know, it was important for us to create a new platform for us to tell our story. And it needed to be a bigger story. It needed to be a more strategic story, you know, being a more full service strategic partner. And we wanted to really kind of bring to bear the forces that we saw that were shaping businesses and brands today.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned story. That kind of quite nicely ties into my next question, which is around what we even mean by brand in the first place. Because I think that, you know, in times gone by, people might have heard brand and thought logos, colors, fonts, all that kind of basic stuff. And that's all obviously still very important. But often when we talk about brand these days, we're talking about things like purpose, mission, and even the brand story, as you've suggested. So with all of that in mind, with all those different elements of brand, what was the very first thing you did when you started thinking about how you were going to reposition Valtech?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And yeah, story is definitely a big, it's an important way in which we sort of connect with each other and the way that businesses, you know, connect with their audiences. So I think that at the size that we are, and being a global company, we really needed to find the authentic truth in the DNA of the company, right? And as a global company, right, it was really important for us to speak with all of our employees globally in all of the different countries, all of the different disciplines. We wanted to do it at different levels of the organization as well. And we also were lucky enough to speak with some of our clients to see, you know, how they saw Valtech as a partner. We have a lot of technology partners. We speak a lot to the analyst community, like Forrester and Gartner. So we you know, really sort of embarked on this journey to find sort of the authentic truth and sort of the DNA of the organization. And it's, you know, it's interesting, right? When you're in the services space, everybody does the same stuff, right? And so like, and we all like to think that we do it differently, but it's not until you find really the DNA that you're able to, you know, find a way that feels really true to kind of speak about yourselves. And for Valtech, you know, I think what we realized, and what I realized, because I had come from sort of the big agency world, and Valtech was a very different type of company, is that there was a really unique culture in the way that the company had organically grown and had grown through acquisition over the years. And culture is really important in this innovation space that we're in, because you need to be able to do things differently. And your culture will drive how teams collaborate or not, and sort of bringing to bear new ideas and looking at the world differently. And so what we found, it was the common thread, speaking to people around the world, is that there was really this, what I would call a culture of goodwill, a real interest to collaborate, and that actually became pretty central to the story that we, you know, wanted to tell, and also it sort of became embedded in our new sort of the visual part of our identity as well.
Sure. And I'd love to talk about how we, or how you rather, how you kind of told that story on the visual side of things. But before we do, you mentioned culture there, and I think you were talking about sort of the internal culture at Valtech. But do you have to consider other cultures globally when you're talking about a global rebrand? You know, do you have to start with what's going to work in Spain and what's going to work in Brazil and what's going to work in the US? Or do you start in that kind of HQ, if you like, and kind of spread that message outwards?
Yeah, I mean, there's a sort of a process that you go through to make sure that, you know, the language that you use, the visuals that you use, the colors that you use, are not going to be sort of a red flag in certain cultures. And we're lucky in that we're pretty connected network, and we were able to involve folks from around the world to kind of look at things as they were coming together. We it was a global team that worked on the brand itself too. So, you know, from the get-go, we had a multicultural sort of lens on things, but then we started to progressively share things with others around the world as they were coming together.
Sure. So once you had the story of Valtech kind of nailed down, how did you translate that into a creative visual image?
Yeah, so I mean, there's you know, sort of a you know, the process of doing exploratory that is you know, pretty core to you know, how you go about these things. I think that there were certain qualities that we that were going to be important for us, is like the company was in this next chapter and was at this next level. We wanted the new visual identity to feel elevated as well. So there was, it was important that there was a sense of sophistication and a premium aspect of the brand, right? As we were, you know, at this new scale and could offer this broader sort of range of services. And as we also started to publish more thought leadership and started to bring more of our category and strategic expertise to bear in the way that we were interfacing with clients, we wanted there to be this sense of intelligence that came through, and sort of the way that we looked at the typefaces, our typeface selection. There's a grid system in the design that sort of come together to achieve all of those things. But I think that there was also this range that we needed here. Like there's, you know, creativity is a sort of a big part of driving innovation, and it's a big part of, you know, the services that we offer, you know, our clients. And so we wanted to have a some tools in our toolbox here to kind of turn things up and down. So our color palette became one of the core devices there that we could create this range of things that felt very kind of serious or consultative or more inspirational and electric. And our color palette also became, you know, it's a very vibrant, a colorful palette that we're using, and is really representative of the sort of the multicultural, sort of global nature of the company too.
Yeah. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, particularly in B2B, there are certain industries where lots of companies have this same look and feel, and they're quite indistinguishable in a way. And perhaps that's because those companies don't want to take a risk, or perhaps it's that they want to seem very, you know, professional and serious. And that ends up kind of falling into the same old cliches. Obviously, though, it's important to try and stand out if you can on a visual level. So what traps do you think that these companies are falling into? And how do you think our listeners who perhaps are going through something similar and, you know, want to make their brand stand out, how can they make their brand actually look different?
Yeah, I mean it's a tricky one, right? I think you know, design is always a reflection of the times, right? And there's these sort of you know, it's just like fashion, right? There's these things out in the ether and the zeitgeist that are you know, find their way there and influence the car that we want to buy or the clothes that we want to wear. And then as designers, we become very influenced by that too. I think the I don't want to call it a trap per se, but I feel like, you know, one of the big drivers over the past 5 years in the design world was how you can scale brands elegantly through design systems, right? And this was really necessary as you know, we enter face so much with brands through the interface. So this idea of how you can elegantly scale the brand became really important to achieve sort of the reach you know, that businesses and brands need. So it was driven by sort of a functional need and a functional lens. And I think that the pendulum for quite a while there was swinging towards you know, what many call the sea of sameness, where you would, you know, look at you know, every other app that you would open up on your phone, you feel like the where was the brand, right? Like, you know, Facebook looked the same as Airbnb and others. I think that, you know, that's important, but I think that there's, you know, the pendulum starting to is now starting to swing in the other direction, where there is I think more of an imperative to be more visually recognizable. So we're starting to see that trend emerge. Starting to see this phrase "weird," the return of weird in the zeitgeist a bit, right? Which really I think is maybe less about literally being weird and more about this idea of being brave and you know, not being afraid to be different. And I would say, like, if I were to kind of boil these things down to advice, I would say, like, if I kind of pull way out, you know, sort of big picture, I would say build diverse teams, right? I mean, that's going to be true across everything that you're doing, whether it's technology, advertising, branding, you know, the things that we're putting out in the world should be created and be a reflection you know, of the audiences that they are serving, right? And so you know, diverse teams are going to always make the work better and always bring sort of a new way of looking at things to the world. So I think that that's one. And then I guess to bring it back to this idea of story, the visual design should be an extension of the strategy and the DNA of the company. So, like, the design is another way of telling your story. It's amplifying your story. It's not decoration. So I would say, you know, bring it back to the strategy, bring it back to the story where the truths, and you know, yeah, start there and always kind of return back to, you know, what's true.
Yeah, and be weird if possible as well, by the sounds of things.
That's right.
So I think one of the things you said in that was that, you know, it's important to be visually recognizable. And of course, that's the case. You know, marketers, that one of the biggest challenges we have is cutting through the noise. You know, you go on social media and you're bombarded with adverts and video and content, and finding something that actually stands out and catches your imagination for even just half a second and lets you click through is a hugely valuable thing. In your experience, is it possible to actually prove the success of a brand rebuild like yours, or is it something that really you can only see the impact of over 10, 15 years?
So the answer is yes, you can prove it. That's, you know, more my strategy coworkers could speak, I think, a bit more in depth about it. So there's a couple aspects to it. One is it depends, right? If you're a big global company like I recall years ago, General Electric rebranded, right? I think forgetting what the platform was, it was something around imagination or whatever. And that was a big deal, right? That was a really big shift for them. And if you kind of look at the size of that company and all of the different parts of their communications and their products and services where that brand needed to take shape, I mean, something like that, like probably many years before they could see how that was working for them. But I think depending on the scale of your company and the type of company you are, you know, Pepsi, you know, recently rebranded again, right? And so I'm sure that they're able to, you know, because there's such this direct correlation between, you know, the product that they're putting on the shelf and sales, they're probably able to see, you know, some data there. I think there are other tools. There's a thing called the Net Promoter Score, that's used quite a bit across different, you know, businesses to measure a lot of different things. So you can use things like that. I think for us, you know, because we're on the front line so much with our clients, with analysts, with our technology partners, we've started to see immediate returns on the work that we've done. So you know, it's the first thing. It's provided a great way in being in the services business. It's provided a great reason to sort of talk about ourselves and reintroduce ourselves to our existing clients. And talk about ourselves in a new way. And so we've seen a lot of great results from that. Them introducing us to other parts of the organization or saying, I didn't realize that you could do that for us. Let's talk further about that. Same thing with our technology partners. Like there's very much not, and it's not just sort of these expanded services, it's just the story that we're starting to tell about you know, how we're connecting who we are and what we do to what we see happening in the world around us. So it's again, that's all very kind of anecdotal right now, but there's definitely a lot of ways to measure it. And I think that the answer is it depends on sort of the scale of the company in terms of how long you're going to be able to really get a sense of the impact of the rebrand.
Yeah, of course. I think we are coming up to the sort of end of our time today, but I've got one more question while I've got you. Normally, the sorts of people we speak to on the podcast are chief marketing officers or heads of marketing or head of a specific function within marketing. But it's rare that I speak to someone who is, you know, on the purely on the creative side of things. In your experience, you know, what things do you perhaps dislike or hate about working with marketers? And is there anything you'd like to say to them? Is there something that you feel would make your job easier and make the company better if they kind of took that feedback on board? Or am I digging a bit too deep?
I don't think there's nothing that I hate. I mean, I love my job and I you know, very much the you know, work a lot with CMOs and that part of the organization. I feel, you know, very lucky to be able to do that. I think that the there is you know, so a common trend that we're seeing across you know, the C-suite, both in the office of the CMO, but also the CIO and the CTO. And that is in this accelerated, digitally accelerated world that we are in today, There is this greater realization that when everybody has easy access now to the best, it has become best practices, and we call that this a race to parity. So there is a greater need, kind of a return to creativity, right? This shift to invest the cost savings that you're getting from the scale and the optimization of digital into innovation. And this need now, imperative to be brave and be creative and innovate in order to be able to kind of leap ahead and differentiate and lead. Because again, this idea that there was an idea before that digital leadership equaled business leadership, but now there really is much more easy access to the best technology. So I would say, be brave and invest those cost optimizations into innovation.
Well, David, thank you very much. I think that's a great place to leave it. So, thank you very much, and hopefully we'll speak to you again soon.
Great. Cheers. Thank you.
Bye.